Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and in this episode I want to look at Russian proto-fascism in the early period of the 20th century, 1905 to about 1906-1907. And the reason why I want to look at this, and the reason why we think of it as being proto-fascism, is that it doesn't really have all the aspects of fascism that we see after the First World War, Italian and German fascism, obviously, in terms of the development of a Führer principle or a Duce, the idea of the inspired leadership, this very modernist, futurist Italian fascist idea of dynamism and action and all that kind of thing. But the one of the kind of the criteria of fascism, the relationship between the elite and the mob, and the kind of the stirrings of racist xenophobic populism in Russia as a response to the development of parties of organized labor, that's was clearly there, and we're going to kind of investigate that in a moment. Now, the text I'm working from is the first part of the trilogy by Stephen Kotkin on Stalin. I believe the second one has been published recently. This is The Paradoxes of Power, 1878 to 1928. Brilliantly written. One of the things that Stephen Kotkin does is he gives a kind of a very, very rich contextual picture around the career of Stalin, and talking about pre-revolutionary Russia, pre-First World War Russia. One of the things that really stands out is the fact that the movements on the extreme right in that period of time actually dwarf the liberal centre and the democratic and radical left. And the fact of the matter is that whilst we think of fascism, one of the facets of fascism as being this relationship between the elite and the mob, between the autocracy here and the peasantry, the proto-fascists of Russia were not really initially motivated and organised by the elites. They are kind of a spontaneous and rather self-forming organisation, or a set of organisations that are really responding to the kind of anxieties that poor Russians have about the encroachment of modernity and the development, the dramatic changes of economic and social changes that are taking inside the Russian Empire at that time. They are later used by the various elites, as we shall see, to achieve strategic political ends, but they're not created by them. So there is a kind of an easy relationship. So Stephen Kotkin writes that, for example, in the number of social democrats had dramatically increased from 3,250 in 1904 to around 80,000 in 1907, which this is a significant amount. The Social Democratic Workers' Party had smatterings of success on the periphery of the Russian Empire, protecting Ukraine, but this is more kind of the heartland of Russia. The Constitutional Democrats had 120,000 supporters, and the Constitutionalist Party, the Octoberists, had about 25,000 members. The Octoberists were the right of centre political grouping. The SRs, the Social Revolutionaries, had a membership of about 50,000. But if you put together all the different groups of the Union of Russian People, which is a staunchly monarchist and national chauvinist organisation, this was founded in November 1905, you're looking at about 300,000 members. And this was organised across the Russian Empire, down to the kind of the small town and the village level. So it was quite sophisticated and well organised a system. So Stephen Kotkin writes, during the revolutionary uprising, he's talking about 1905, in which liberal constitutionalism was pushed to the forefront, while socialism emerged as an empire-wide aspiration, the rise of the illiberal Union of Russian People constituted a remarkable story. Until 1905, self-styled patriotic elements faced legal limitations in expressing themselves publicly, having to be content with religious processionals, military victory commemorations, imperial funerals, and coronations. That revolutionary year, moreover, more conservatives found themselves caught out, unwilling to enter, let alone master, the political arena. But the Union of Russian People was different. As the most prominent of many upstart rightist organisations in Russia, the Union brought together courtiers, professionals and churchmen with townspeople, workers and peasants, drawing in the disaffected and the disoriented as well as the patriotic. The Union managed to sweep in the lower orders and middle strata for Tsar, faith and fatherland, stealing a march on the left. The Tsarist regime, stymied by rightist establishment opposition in the Duma and the State Council, appeared to have the option of grassroots mobilisation. So what does all that mean? Well, during the 1905 revolution, which had been brewing in Russia for at least since 1902, if not significantly longer, during that revolutionary year, the story that we hear most about is the union between the bourgeoisie, the liberal bourgeoisie, and the more radical proletariat, the working class. As it says, liberal constitutionalism is pushed to the forefront, so the aspirations of the bourgeoisie to have a Duma, to have a limitation of the Tsar's powers, and to have the kinds of things that were demanded across Europe really in 1848, and that Russian autocracy had managed to avoid for over half a century. These liberal bourgeois parties really relied upon the working classes in various Russian towns and cities to do much of the actual street fighting in some cases and the mannings of the barricades. And they were seen as the leadership of the movement. Sergei Vita quite neatly cuts the head off the snake in 1905 by drafting the October Manifesto to really appeal to the bourgeoisie, and then allowing the Tsar to take his revenge on the working classes, thus dividing the two and ensuring that they would never fully trust one another ever again. But here we have this kind of this other part of this story, a radical extremist right-wing organization, the Union of Russian Peoples, and it manages to be able to have cross multi kind of class social appeal, as it says, finding a common cause between courtiers, professionals, churchmen, townspeople, workers, and peasants, and it unites them behind notions of identity and nationhood, Tsar, faith, and fatherland, really the autocracy, Russia, and orthodoxy. And why does this happen? Well, it's actually often easier to unite people during times of immense social and cultural change behind established and fixed concepts of identity than it is to suggest to them that social reform or control of the factories or whatever might be a more attractive goal. Fascism and fascisms are adept at speaking to loss and bewilderment, and they are adept at promising the follower, the adherent of fascism, with a deep sense of identity and belonging. Many of the critical, the Frankfurt School books on fascism were written, particularly the Eric Fromm's The Fear of Freedom, were written around this. And he said basically kind of disorientation and loneliness was a key factor in Hitler's rise. Well, there's much of that in Russia as the country dramatically changes. People are torn, sort of sucked in from the land to the towns and cities. They go from being perhaps sometimes artisans to being wage labourers. And the process of modernity that have happened in Britain over at least a century is accelerated into a couple of decades in Russia. And people rightly are anxious about the old Russia that they understood being swept away. And this isn't just a working class experience. If you go back as far as the 1880s and you read books based on the period, such as Turgenev's Fathers and Sons, the question about social change and about the pace of social change and what will happen to the Russia we once knew, those are writ large throughout the story and various other writings of the time. One of the key distinctions between the kind of conservative nationalism and the kind of elite politics of the right that had emerged in the late Tsarist period, one of the key distinctions between that and the new fascism of the Union of the Russian People was that this was a mass politics. It was the politics of public places, of demonstrations, the idea of direct action, of no longer waiting for a political process to deliver the kinds of outcomes, and xenophobic nationalist outcomes that were required. And this is a hugely destabilizing force within Russian politics, to have this large body of individuals impatient for radical change, and impatient for radical change often brought about as a result of violence.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right?
For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
The Union decried liberalism, capitalism, and the Jews. These were the three evils of an encroaching modernity, and the Jews were accused of being behind it all, obviously. The notion that that liberalism presented to Russia, which had really been in existence in Russian politics since the end of the Napoleonic Wars onwards, and found its most memorable moment with the Decembrists' revolt in 1825, which was swiftly crushed. The liberalism had been a very minimal challenge, really, to the power of autocracy, but was seen as something anti-Russian, against the very notion of what it was to be Russian. There's this pan-Slavic idea of exceptionalism, that Russia had its own special path through history that didn't involve the development of liberalism, of a constitutional monarchy, of the rule of law, civil rights, or any of that kind of thing. And certainly it didn't then involve the development of liberal capitalism or kind of free trade capitalism that was developing in Europe, Western Europe, and America. No, this was these notions were anathemas to conservative Russia. Even when you had the likes of Sergei Vitter attempting to deeply integrate, far more deeply integrate Russia into the world economy, and much of Russia's economic boom that happens in the last decade before the First World War is based on this integration. The problem that these kinds of developments of what we would now think of as globalization, the integration of nation states into a world economic system, the problem that invariably has is that there is collateral damage, unemployment, prices and inflation soaring out of the control of national governments and individuals and communities are being devastated by the vagaries of market forces. All these things were seen as an immense threat and kind of an anti-Russian concepts, capitalism and liberalism. And the easiest people to blame, obviously, were Jews. Much of the later Nazi anti-Semitic playbook is the product of earlier Russian pioneers, though obviously Hitler was a keen adherent of Austrian and German anti-Semites as well, but many of the key tenets of modern anti-Semitism come from Russia. This proto-Russian fascism, in the words of Stephen Kotkin again, emphasised the uniqueness of Russia's historical trajectory, rejected Europe as a model, preached the need for orthodox primacy over Jews and Catholics, and demanded the restoration of Russia's traditions. So it was a very angry reaction against the perceived encroachment of Western values on Russia. And it makes sense that this would occur, because ever since the end of the Crimean War and the establishment of the fact that Russia had been significantly weakened and humbled by two Western European powers, there had been a steady erosion of Russian sovereignty and a steady development of the fear that Russia might simply wind up an economic colony of Europe. And just as with the Qing Empire in the east and the Ottoman Empire to the south, a prolonged struggle between the forces of tradition and the forces of modernization was going on in Russia, and the anxieties that this unleashes as to if the forces of modernity do triumph, then whither Russia, what will happen to Russia? These are key anxieties in the minds of many Russian people who are sensing a sense of threat to their own identity. And again, this is what fascism's old and contemporary are kind of about. During the 1905 revolution, the state is under siege, or so it appears, from revolutionaries from the left. And the inability of the state to crush the left, to wipe the left out, is a source of disdain from the far right, from the Union. And the Union's kind of right-wing vigilantes, the boot boys, referred to as the Black Hundreds, not only launched pogroms against the Jews during 1905, but also believed that they could act as kind of auxiliaries to the army and the police, breaking some rebellious peasant skulls and giving the workers the beating that they believed that they were due in order to kind of push them back into line. Russian socialists were quick to see that, along with the forces of autocracy, that fascism developing in Russia was a key threat to hopes of revolution. Socialists forced occasionally the Union of Russian Russian people to abandon outdoor rallies and to hide indoors due to the threat of counter-demonstrations from the left. And then there was a genuine fear on the far right that social revolutionaries or anarchist bombers would kill large numbers of them, and in much the same way as they had assassinated government ministers throughout 1905. And the key text that would unify the fascist right in Russia and would have an infamous legacy on anti-Semitism throughout the 20th century was, of course, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. This was a fabricated transcript of a supposed Jewish organization's meetings in a smoke-filled room where supposedly the leaders of the Jews of the world got together in a global conspiracy that was so clever that it was invisible except to people that read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and then they could figure it all out. It was first published in St. Petersburg on the 28th of August 1903 through to September the 7th that year, in Zhimaya, which was a publication which was paid for by the Interior Minister Vyacheslav von Plev, and it was published by Pavel Krushevan, a Moldavian publisher who thought not only to compile the lies of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, but also instigated pogroms against the Jews and led to the founding of the Bessarabian branch of the Union of Russian People in 1905. The creation of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was intimately connected to Russia's Okhrana, the secret service, was the first real evidence of a kind of a connection between the autocracy and the fascist right. The autocracy had sought to sup with a very long spoon initially, noticing that when they did infiltrate, using the Ukraine, the Union of Russian Peoples, that they had a kill list, not just of Jews or socialists, but of government ministers as well, who weren't seen as being sufficiently anti-Jewish enough. So there was a great wariness by the autocracy. But as the situation deteriorated in the run-up to 1905, the willingness to embrace extremism became more and more apparent. The Union didn't like to think of itself as a political party. It liked to think of itself as a political movement. It liked to think of itself as the people, the Narod, as a unit of the polity itself. And this was something that was far far divorced from the kind of the petty bourgeois concerns of everyday politics, and something that was raised to a more sanctified and rarefied level, based around the very workings of the interior life of the people itself. And this was, again, part of the blueprint of later fascisms, the German Volk, for example, and the idea that the whatever the nation was, whatever the national tribe was, that one individual could speak for it. And there were distinct links to the notion of autocracy. The autocracy itself, long before the advent of Peter the Great's reforms, the kind of the mystical way that Nicholas II thought of the autocracy, was in its purest form. It was a connection between the Tsar and the peasants. And that anything, government ministers, bureaucrats, anything that stood in the way as a kind of a filter or a barrier was inherently wrong and kind of contrary to the word or of God. And fascists in the Black Hundreds and in the Union of Russian People craved this notion or this kind of intimate connection between the Tsar and people. Much of it is obviously, you know, complete fantasy and things that had never really existed in the first place. However, in the final analysis, whatever the attempts to forge connections between the autocratic right and the fascist right of the street and the mob, it never really quite worked out, and the extreme nationalist right was divided, you know, by the time 1914 came around, between a parliamentary or a Duma conservatism and the fascist radicalism of the streets. Anyway, I'm going to finish that. I hope you found this useful, and I will catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do swing by the Facebook page. I need the kind of the involvement of the tribe at the moment. I've got some new ideas I want your opinions on, so do swing by, and I'm going to post some cool stuff there pretty soon. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you soon. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.